Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, the major developments economic of this past week, there were a number, but we're going to focus on three. One is this Bitcoin mania that continues. Most notably, the price surged for one Bitcoin token over $11,000. That's a 30,000% increase since Bitcoin was first introduced in 2011. Oh, and then it contracted 30%. Well, why did that happen? Why the continued accelerating surge in the early part of the week and then the contraction and now, of course, recovery? Where is it going? What does all this Bitcoin mania, cryptocurrency, signify? Well, that's the first topic we're going to address here today. The second is the Senate. This Trump version of the tax cut for the rich and their corporations has passed out of the committee and into the Senate at large. And I think, I don't know if they've decided on this or whether they're still debating it. But it looks like it's going to pass if it hasn't already passed through the Senate. And what's the difference between the House and the Senate versions is an important question. And what does it mean? What does it mean for the economy? And once it passes the Senate, which looks like it will, if it hasn't already, haven't checked this morning, but it looks like it will. Then it will go to a conference of the House and Senate leadership, which is Republican, and they will try to consolidate and reconcile the differences, and then we will have a full vote on the differences. Looks like it's going to pass. Well, surprise, surprise. And what will that mean? Well, one thing it means is the stock market, every time it looks like it's going one more step in passage, the stock market goes up 300 points. That happened yesterday when John McCain threw in his hat in support of the tax bill, his outgoing gift to his rich friends, and the stock market went 350 points one day. Bubble brewing in the stock market, of course, trying to catch up with the cryptocurrency bubble. And should it pass, watch another 300, 400, 500 point surge in the Dow and the S&P and the NASDAQ. Yes. Well, why? Why this connection between the tax cuts and the stock market? Well, very simply put, it means a big additional cash injection into corporations and non-corporate businesses and wealthy investors, the 1%. Major, major overnight windfall. Well, how much of a windfall? Well, estimates are that these tax cuts will add to retained earnings, a form of profits, for corporations, depending on the industry and the company, between 11 and 26%. Well, would you want to get a 11, 26% overnight increase in your disposable income? Yes, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Yes. Well, investors know that that huge increase in corporate profits overnight because of the tax cuts will mean for them even more buybacks, stock buybacks and dividend payouts. So What do they do with all those stock buybacks? Well, the stock buybacks will drive up the stock market, and the dividend payouts will give wealthy investors more money to speculate in stocks and bonds and bitcoins and so forth. Yeah, so, you know, the corporations are a conduit. You cut corporate taxes by $1.5 trillion. That gives the corporations more money to distribute to their major shareholders in buybacks and dividend payouts. And then you cut taxes on those who receive those distributions and buybacks and payout and dividends by cutting the personal income tax for the wealthy at the same time as the corporate income tax and the non-corporate business pass-through tax. They get to keep more so they can invest more. You see, it's a corporate the corporate tax and the business taxes are one level, and you cut those, you get more to distribute, and those who get the distribution, you cut their taxes, and they keep more as well. And the ideology machine is in high gear now that tax cuts will not only create jobs, the tax cuts will raise wages, the tax cuts will boost gross domestic product and pay for themselves and reduce the deficit because they pay for themselves. It's all a lie. As we'll talk about later, there is no causation proof that business tax cuts create jobs. You know, the whole logic is that you give corporations and businesses more money to keep, and they will, the assumption, they will then invest it and expand their businesses and hire more people, which means more income, more wages, more consumption, more GDP. That's the assumption, but it's a lie because there's no real empirical proof of that relationship, you see. And besides, corporations are in the U.S. alone are sitting on $2 trillion in cash, and the multinationals have another $2 to $3 trillion stuffed offshore that they won't bring back to pay taxes. So, you know, there's $4 to $5 trillion they're already sitting on, and they're not really investing that in the U.S. to create jobs. Why do you think giving them another $1.5 trillion is all of a sudden, $1.5 trillion on top of the $2 to $4 trillion they already have, is all of a sudden going to release this flood of investment that will create jobs? Well, they're not talking about that, are they? Apparently, $2-3 trillion is not enough to invest in the U.S. We got to give them a couple trillion more, and then somehow, once it gets beyond $3 trillion, they will invest. What an absurd argument! And it rests upon this incredibly false economic notion that mainstream economists still peddle, that somehow you increase disposable income by businesses, it will automatically transition in the short run into investment. I mean, that was debunked way back in 1935, you know, when Keynes raised his challenge. Well, they quickly shut up that argument. Took him a couple of decades, but they finally put Keynes in the corner and continued with their pre-Keynes neoclassical economic notions that you put more money in the hands of business, they will invest it automatically. Not true. And, of course, if they don't invest and create jobs, then you don't have an increase in wage income, and you don't have an increase in GDP and consumption as a result. What you do get is more deficits and debt. You know, in 2000, the U.S. federal debt was $4 trillion. Since 2001, we've cut taxes under Bush, under Obama, for businesses and investors over $10 trillion. Well, that generate any real investment? No, real investment has been on this long-run decline in the U.S., and not surprisingly, wages, except for the top 10% in tech and so forth, you know, wages for most of your workers, real wages adjusted for inflation, have been declining for the median and below, or stagnant. Yeah. And, of course, productivity, which would be increased if you had significant real investment, productivity would be rising, but that's flattening out as well, long-term. Well, not surprising, you know, it's flattening out because there's not that much real investment and they're not generating that much real wage income as a result. So this is all the ideology of tax increases, the ideology, you see. Tax cuts create jobs, tax cuts raise wages, tax cuts pay for themselves, right? There won't be deficits or debt because they'll pay for themselves. It's all a lie, you know? There's no real empirical support for all that. But that's all you read in the corporate media. And then the biggest lie is Trump says, oh, this tax bill will cost me millions. I don't think there's ever been a bigger liar in politics than Donald Trump. I mean, it's just brash, crazen misrepresentations of reality. Well, let me tell you why. He's going to make a lot, even though he says it's going to cost me millions, right? First of all, both the House and the Senate are going to eliminate the alternative minimum tax. You know, in 2005, the only year he's released his taxes, Trump, he paid $35 million only because of the alternative minimum tax. In other words, the AMT is all about if the rich folks game the system, they got to do their taxes a second time over and pay at least a minimum, right? It's a minimum, but at least something, right? Well, he had to pay $35 million. Well, under both provisions, the AMT will be corporate AMT and personal AMT. There's two kinds. They'll be gone. Well, is that going to cost him millions? I think just the opposite. He'll make millions. And then there's another element in his taxes that's important. You see, Trump is really a wheeler-dealer. He plays off of his name, Trump. He doesn't really own those properties. He licenses his name to those properties. And in fact, he licenses his name to 500 different projects. And he claims the income from this licensing as part of a business pass-through income, 500, business pass-through. And under this bill, the business pass-through is going to be reduced, the rate, from 39.6% to 25, or maybe 27, something like that. Well, that's a massive tax cut for him. If most of his income is pass-through income and AMT is going, what a liar. You know, he stands up there and he tells people and they don't understand and they clap. Yeah. Well, there's 30% of people in this country would clap for him no matter what he did. You know? Anyway, let's get off of the tax cut thing. We'll come back to that. But very clearly, the ideology machine is in high gear to justify the tax cuts. That'll be coming here in the next couple of weeks. All right. Let's turn to, the third thing we're going to cover today, if we have time. You know, first thing is this Bitcoin mania. The second thing is this, the Senate tax cuts. And the ideology behind it. And third is, that happened this week, is the confirmation of this fellow Powell as the new chair for the Federal Reserve, the central bank. Right. What that signifies, why they chose Powell, is clearly the bankers want a continuity at the Fed. The continuity, of course, ever since Greenspan in 86, and then Bernanke that followed, and Janet Yellen that followed, is to provide massive liquidity to the banks, which means very low interest rates, massive money supply, and liquidity from the central bank creates very low interest rates, and they want to keep it low. Well, why do they want to keep it low? Because if you raise interest rates too much, you're going to prop up the dollar, and the dollar's going to rise, and all the multinational U.S. corporations offshore are going to lose exchange rate profitability. Because if the dollar rises, the value of the currencies in which they're doing business offshore declines, and paper profits, they lose it when they convert from those foreign currencies back to the dollar. Okay, so that and other reasons are why the central banks will, central bank, the Fed, is not going to raise rates appreciably. But see, the central banks have a problem because all this massive liquidity is creating all these financial bubbles, ultimately. That's the source of it. And financial instability. And boosting stocks and bonds and bubbles, derivatives, so forth, you know, and they know that. Plus, they know if they don't, if rates are near zero, next recession comes, they have no tools to make it look like they're doing something, you know. So they got to raise rates, but they can't raise them very much. And they can't sell off their balance sheets worth $25 trillion, all the major central banks, because if they do that, that will increase rates. So they're doing this smoke and mirrors talk about raising rates, and they're just doing it in a token version, and smoke and mirrors about selling their balance sheets, but they're not going to do that. Token, that's all. They can't. Well, Powell is, he's safe. He's part of the whole policy, the monetary policy, central bank policy first and foremost. And fiscal austerity for the rest of us, except tax cuts for the rich. You see, that's neoliberal policy in a nutshell since 2008. In a nutshell, well, the one exception to the fiscal austerity spending is a defense. Keep that going, right? Keep the tax cuts going. That's the nature for the rich and investors. That's the nature of fiscal policy. But monetary policy is in the driver's seat. And that's what I covered, by the way, in my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, published a couple months ago by Clarity Press. You can read some reviews. Go to my blog and there to my website. You can read several, in-depth reviews of the book. At the end of their rope really means that this whole eight-year experiment of zero interest rates is shifting to some token increases, and that means that whole policy is subsidizing the banks and the corporations with trillions and trillions of dollars of low interest rates, right, is now shifting once again to subsidizing the capitalist state, subsidizing corporations and investors, not so much with monetary policy, but with fiscal policy, with massive tax cuts, you see. This is the shell game they play, you know. For years, they do it with monetary policy, but when that reaches the end of the rope, then they turn to continuing subsidization through tax policy and other fiscal policies, you know. The hallmark of 21st century neoliberal capitalist economy is increasing subsidization, direct subsidization of capital incomes by the state. You know, the legislatures are undertaking now the tax cutting, and the central bank, quasi-government institution controlled by the banks, pretty much does it on the monetary side. And then they switch, they trade off, you see. And that's what's going on. But, you know, it's interesting to note that, you know, one of the hallmarks of all this 21st century neoliberal policy is an increasing rate of subsidization of capital incomes. Is that because they can't earn those incomes on their own? Well, or just that they're greedy, they can and they want more, and they're calling on their state to do that, their governments to do that. Okay, so that's enough on the Senate tax cuts. We'll come back to that if we have time. I want to spend the rest of the show here talking about bitcoins. We've been talking about bitcoins leading up to today's show here and there. What's driving? Obviously, it's a bubble, right? 30,000% increase. And from 1,000, well, less than 1,900 and some dollars a coin at the beginning of this year, and, you know, over 11,400. And even though it contracted, it will go back up. Well, what's behind the Bitcoin surge and this little recent contraction, correction? Where's it all going? What does it signify? Well, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, software, internet-based creation, whether it's money or a commodity, you know, that's debatable. But it is a phenomenon of the late financial cycle. You see these kind of bubbles when the economic cycle, the business cycle, which is composed of a financial cycle and a real cycle, and their interaction. By the way, to digress, you know, mainstream economists don't understand financial cycles at all. They are trained in trying to understand real cycles, you know, real indicators. But financial, they don't understand the financial side. And what's happened to capitalist financial restructuring in the last, globally in the last few decades, they have no idea what's going on. You know, especially the liberals and both wings. See, there's two wings of mainstream economics. I call them hybrid Keynesians. They aren't really Keynesians. They're this strange mishmash of pre-Keynes and Keynes. On the one hand, and then the retro-classicalists, you know, who are still teaching 19th century economics, they don't understand what's going on. The academics don't understand. The Bitcoin is and the cryptocurrencies, you see, Bitcoin is just one of a couple hundred cryptocurrencies. I mean, it's accelerating, creating these digital currencies, or I call them digital tulips, see, referencing the tulip, the tulip mania in 1630s in Holland. I recently gave an interview on RT TV, and you can access that from my blog. I think it may also be, it's on YouTube, right? Condensed 4-minute explanation of why bitcoins are really digital tulips. You know, the tulip mania back in the 1630s was driven by Holland, a small country, establishing an economic set of colonies, an empire, you know, in the east here with the spice trade and so forth. And all that money was brought back to Holland from that trading, and there was such an excess of liquidity and money, little country, you know, where were they going to invest it and so forth, so they started speculating in different securities, and tulip bulbs became a security, and people kept buying it because the price kept going up as they kept buying it, and they were just purely speculating. Buying tulip bulbs, not because they wanted tulip bulbs or they had any value, but because the price was going up because everyone was buying the demand for tulip bulbs, and they were making speculative profits hand over fist. Well, you know, that purely demand-driven speculation cannot continue forever, but, you know, they thought it would. And then, of course, the bubble burst, and the Dutch economy was wrecked for an entire decade and generation, and that was the beginning of the decline of the Dutch competition with the British for world trade, and they had to turn over New York City, New Amsterdam, to the British as a result. Anyway, that's the tulip bubble, and same thing is going on with Bitcoin. It's a Bitcoin bubble. And they're buying Bitcoin simply because the price is going up, you see. and the price creates its own demand, and the demand drives the price up, and that cycle keeps going. But when it busts, as it must, because it can't go on forever, what is the contagion effects? See, that's what's critical about Bitcoin. What's the contagion effect here? Well, we'll talk about that shortly. There's growing contagion risks. You know, some say, oh, Bitcoin is, you know, just a small, isolated market. Cryptos are a small, isolated market, yes, but it's growing incredibly fast. And we're beginning to see linkages between the cryptocurrencies and other financial markets. And that's how you get the contagion. You know, when the one financial market crashes, it spills over and drags down the others. Well, what are those contagion connections here, potentially, between Bitcoin and other financial markets? We'll talk about that. But first, let's look at, you know, what's driving the price and the demand for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Well, most fundamentally, it's that cryptocurrencies are derived from this new software technology called blockchain, which the tech companies have been developing blockchain. Well, what is blockchain? You know, that's the foundation for this thing. Well, blockchain is a new kind of technology that allows global and all other transaction costs, purchasing and so forth, buying and selling things on the internet directly. Without having to go through banks because of different currencies, you see. I mean, if you buy something or have money transferred from abroad, it's got to go through a series of banks, offshore and to onshore and so forth, and SWIFT codes and all that stuff, and it's slow and it's costly. And the middlemen charge fees. Well, blockchain will allow transactions to occur almost instantaneously off of this whole network. Direct that reduces transaction costs tremendously, particularly for the banking system. And it accelerates the processing of the transactions, which also reduces costs. Blockchain promises a revolution here in global banking, $134 trillion market global banking, and $7 trillion global shipping transactions here, much faster, much cheaper, more direct. Also, you know, down the road, there's really a potential here for revolutionizing a lot of other industries and markets. Some are saying that it will revolutionize the whole real estate industry, right? And individual homeowners will be able to write options on the value of their home, raise money by selling a derivative on your home, future and option on your home. What will that do to home prices? That's interesting, right? And that direct buying and selling through tokens, Bitcoin tokens, I mean, it's a big question mark, but certainly will be an upheaval. So blockchain technology promises to really cause a revolution in all kinds of transactions. We don't know where that all is going to lead, but it certainly will be disruptive. You know, we see technology, you know, we kind of romanticize technology, but it's becoming increasingly clear. But technology is really disruptive, and it's destroying a lot of traditional forms of standard living, you might even say, right? It's disrupting capitalism itself. And at an accelerating rate, you know, creating new business models based on software and internet. And in the case of blockchain, of course, these blockchain software development companies are spinning off bitcoins because cryptocurrency is very amenable to blockchain kind of transactions. In some cases, these companies are developing blockchain, and Bitcoin cryptos are a sort of a spinoff. And others, you know, the whole idea is first and foremost buying and selling a cryptocurrency and initial coin offerings. Right, these companies are startups, and they're raising money, and they're raising money by selling Bitcoins to investors who give them the real money to continue developing their company. You know, we got over 200 of these ICOs going on. They're all trying to create the new standard crypto. They're all competing. You know, and now we see the emergence of what we call blue chip cryptos, like Bitcoin and Ethereum, and a lot of other wannabe cryptos all over the place. Technology is disrupting capitalism. For example, you see it with Amazon, right? Amazon's getting into groceries. Amazon getting everything, right? Amazon is giving the deep six to traditional big box retail companies. Smart retail like Walmart are jumping into the Amazon, Amazoning themselves. But Johnny Come Latelys, you know, like Sears and Penny's, Macy's, they're not going to make it. Macy's might make the next recession, make it through. But certainly Sears and JCPenney's are going to be gone, right? And a bunch of others as well. You know, you're going to have these malls that are going to be ghost towns after the next recession. It's already beginning. Okay, so the Amazon B2B, business-to-business, e-commerce, whatever you want to call it, is devastating traditional industries. And with them, you know, millions of jobs are going to go as well. And then you got the Uberization and the gig economy technology. That's a software again, software solution, you know, where you get the workers to put up their own fixed capital in the form of their cars. You just control the software and the customer, and you know, you give the drivers a little bit of part-time wage income, and you keep you skim off the top. You know, the huge amount, and it's really cheap. There's no cost of goods. You're not making anything. You're just controlling the customer, and with software, it's all software based, but made possible by technology. And then you know, the Uberization, the Amazonization, and now the blockchain. Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and financial tech. You know, this is just the beginning of what they call fintech, financial tech companies, and the revolutionizing of business models and entire industries. And what comes with this financial restructuring revolution is labor market restructuring and revolution. And not for the good of most workers. You know, once they get this driverless car thing going, driverless trucks, Tesla already providing a product they say is coming. What's going to happen to the million truck drivers in this country? Okay, well, they're destroying high-paying jobs after high-paying jobs. And creating a lot of part-time gigs, service-type jobs that don't pay much. And then the government is passing legislation to destroy company-provided fringe benefits and privatize those. We've already seen it with 401Ks and HSAs, you know, and Obamacare, Trump care is really privatization of health care. Okay. Returning to Bitcoins, right? Why is there so much money flowing into Bitcoins? Of course, that money represents demand, accelerating demand, and that drives up the price. And as the price goes up, more money flows in because they want to make speculative profits. according to Coinbase, a crypto trading platform, there are now 13 million accounts buying cryptocurrencies, mostly Bitcoin. In 2017, more than a 300% increase since January in accounts. People are setting up accounts buying Bitcoins. That's why, or buying cryptos. That's why you got all these ICOs, right? People want to buy this stuff, so, you know, company, software company gets a little funding and says, okay, we're going to create our version of the blockchain, and we're going to offer our cryptos here, and you guys take your real money and buy our crypto. We'll give you tokens. You know, it's kind of like a junk bond, right? We'll give you a junk bond, and you give us some real money, and we'll develop our blockchain. You see, that's the connection between the software tech development and the Bitcoin currency. But soon, you know, the profitability of the currency, the cryptocurrency, is far greater than even the software. And the software's not going to go anywhere for a lot of these crypto ICOs. You know, their cryptos are not going to win out here over Bitcoin or Ethereum. But in the meantime, they're going to make a lot of money selling tokens, you see. Okay, it's a pure speculative play. So what's driving this? What's driving this? Well, there's at least 9 or 10 factors driving the price of Bitcoins. Let's talk about those. One is the increasingly desperate search for yield by speculative investors. Search for yield means higher returns, right? As we get into the late cycle, financial cycle, business cycle, you know, the rate of increase in prices and profitability levels off. And but these professional investors want to keep making these, you know, double-digit rates of return profits, in other words. So they keep looking for more and more opportunities that are increasingly high risk. And the search for yield gets even more desperate at the very end, and that's why the money flows into speculative investing like gold and bitcoins and commodities in some cases, etc. Right. So search for yield is one, this trend is one of the drivers here. Also, another driver is we're seeing Bitcoin and crypto demand, which started out mostly what we call retail, and it was non-professional investors, a lot of techies and libertarians and people like that who think, you know, this represents something new and different and outside the control of fiat money created by central banks, et cetera. And, of course, as we will see, it's not taxable, at least yet. We're seeing the shift from retail investors to professional investors. Well, what do you mean? Hedge funds. Hedge funds are about to go all in, as they say, investing in Bitcoin. Already, the Bitcoin market capitalization is $350 billion, which is greater than 95% of all, you know, the individual companies in the S&P 500. The market cap is greater than 95% of the big companies in the U.S., right? So the shift to increasingly professional investors is another important driver of demand and therefore the price increase in Bitcoins. Another factor here is, as I alluded shortly before, it's not taxed. These speculative profits are not taxed, so it's a tax evasion scheme. And it looks like it won't be regulated anytime soon. The Commodity Futures Trading Corporation, CFTC, has signaled it's not going to intervene. That means, you know, government regulation is not coming, and big profits, speculative profits, are made where there's no regulation. Well, in addition to that, because the CFTC is not intervening, the Commodity or Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the largest clearinghouse in the world, has indicated that it's going to allow trading of bitcoins, you know, on its clearinghouse. Well, that's a response to Japan, you see, that jumped in and said, "Oh, we want the center for cryptocurrency trading in Japan, so we're going to support it." All right. And then J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Goldman said they will participate as not investors themselves, but will participate in trading, you know, managing the trading of cryptos for a fee. They're not going to put their money into it, you know, but they'll take a fee. They'll take a fee income here. J.P. Morgan's chairman there, Jamie Dimon, called cryptos a fraud. But they're going to participate in the fraud, apparently, in order to make some fees. But they won't put their own money in. No, no. All right. So what you got with the CME indicating it's going to be a clearinghouse is an indication that there's going to be a trading of futures and options, derivatives, on cryptocurrencies. That's why the hedge funds are going to go all in soon, you see. This legitimizes the whole Bitcoin crypto market. You know, if you're going to have options trading and derivatives, well, that's where the speculators, the big boys, will make their money, you see, on the volatility. They love the volatility. That's where they make their money, up and down. So the CME and Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and hedge funds in Japan are all legitimizing this market, and that's sucking in more demand, more investment, you see. It's here to stay. Yeah, and one of the hot business conferencing segments today is everybody in business wants to find out, well, what is this stuff? You know, should we participate? How can we not if all the money is being made there? So, you know, if you're putting up conferences on bitcoins, you're making money. It's hot. Everyone wants to know more about it and whether they should get in. Right? So the CME and you know, big banks and Goldman Sachs, hedge funds, Japan, all of them are legitimizing this thing. Another source of legitimization is some companies, particularly tech companies, non-bank tech companies, have indicated they will accept Bitcoin tokens as cash. Yeah, this is you know, all these big companies, they have a finance arm that engages in different degrees of financial instrument investing, and some of them are more speculative and risk-taking than others. I think NVIDIA is involved in that, accepting bitcoins as payment. Well, that means that bitcoins that are now basically a commodity, you know, being traded and speculated, may transition into a form of currency used for transactions, you see. And all the multiple ICOs, initial coin offerings going on, I talked about, you know, driving up the price. So, well, that spills over to Bitcoin prices. And then because it's not regulated at all, you've got these shady speculators doing what's called pumping and dumping, right? They pump up the market, and then they sell it, and they dump it, and they make money going down. Then they jump it back in and drive the price back up and so forth, right? Pumping and dumping, wherever there's opaque markets, non-regulated, that's what happens, you know. And, of course, the fact that there's no taxation here, that's driving people into the speculators, into the market. And what's developing is a typical bubble herd mentality, which is typical of all bubbles, like digital tulips, you know, the herd mentality, when you're reaching the peak here, the late cycle. And that's what's going on. Right. Now, there's another problem here, and that is exchange-traded funds in the stock markets and bond markets, passive investing, indexing, right? More and more investors in stocks and bonds are investing in ETFs, exchange-traded funds. But there's increasing concern that this is may cause great instability in stock and bond markets once the corrections in the prices begin. Yes, ETFs. We haven't talked about that enough, but we will. Underlying a lot of the run-up here, driven by, in the stock markets, driven by professional investors. You know, three-fourths of all the investing is by professionals in the stock market now. And, you know, your average investor is just saying, I'm not going to try to figure out what these guys are doing. I'm just going to invest in an index, and that will follow the market up. And index buying here, ETFs, right? Now, the danger is that once we have options trading and future trading, derivatives trading, with the CME establishing a clearinghouse, we're going to have crypto ETFs, which is like a instability on instability. So when the crypto currency declines, the ETFs will be dragged down, and it's a double financial risk, right? Now, another factor driving this is that bitcoins, as a speculative play, are obviously competing with gold as such. Now, $6 trillion global gold market here, right? Stocks are $55 trillion globally. Banks, bonds, rather, $94 trillion. Okay, so gold market, $6 trillion. It's not small change. Well, cryptocurrencies are sucking money out of gold investment and gold speculation. Right. But underlying all of this is this massive increase in money supply and liquidity created by the central banks over the last several decades, accelerating since 2008. Since 2008, as I point out in my book, central bankers at the end of the ropes, the U.S. and other major central banks, you know, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and People's Bank of China, have pumped in fiat money creation here $25 trillion through, you know, in the form of QE and other forms of buying and selling bonds and whatever, and in Japan, Bank of Japan buying stocks. I mean, talk about the state subsidizing the financial markets. Look at Japan. I mean, they're way ahead of everybody else. You know, that's, you know, they think of the U.S. as the great speculative finance capital center. Well, they're even crazier over in Japan. They got the government buying stocks, buying bonds, buying corporate bonds, buying derivatives of various kinds in real estate. I mean, it's... if it wasn't for that, it would have collapsed. You see, capitalism in Japan would have collapsed. And that's all part of this trend, as I said at the beginning of the show, that the state is intervening increasingly more and wider and deeper in order to keep the system from imploding. Well, you know, this $25 trillion... in the U.S., we're, you know, well over $10 trillion, both in QE and refinancing of QE and other forms of purchases of bonds and other things through traditional means by the central bank, has resulted in super low rates. The banks, private banks, borrow at the super low rates, and they loan it out to other speculators and investors who then take that and invest, you know, in stocks and bonds and high-yield junk bonds and some leverage loans and so forth. Right? The low interest rates for 8 years has resulted in this. And we've had over $6 trillion in new bond issues because it's so low. grow. You know, big corporations like Apple, with $268 billion in cash, they still borrow by issuing corporate bonds because the cost, the rate to them is so low. They hold and hoard their cash, and they borrow more. And then they take that borrowing and they distribute it to shareholders, you see, who are clamoring with, you know, with this, all these 2.5 times corporate profits. You know, we want some of that. And demanding stockholders, demanding that they distribute some of that to them from these corporations like Apple and others. So Apple and others go out and they raise bonds and cash that way, and they give them the cash from the bonds, and they hoard their own cash, you see. They keep their $260 billion, 95% of which is offshore, you know, so they don't have to pay taxes. Yes. And that's going to be legitimized now in the Senate bill and the Trump bill here, because they won't have to pay any taxes anymore on offshore. And all their treasure trove of trillions keeping offshore, you know, they can bring it back at, 5% rate or 12% rate or something like that? It depends on, you know, whether it's liquid assets or non-liquid, the rate, but it's dirt cheap, not the 35% rate, not even the 20% new corporate rate under the tax bill, you know, much less even than that. Right. Okay, so, as I said earlier as well, the corporations, you know, they're fat and they can borrow. They're fat in profits. They can borrow. Their taxes are being cut and they can keep even more, and they pass it through in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. That's $6 trillion in the U.S. alone since 2008. $6 trillion in bond issues, $6 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, right? Stock markets are up 400%. If you... you know, collectively, combined, corporate profits nearly tripled, right? And then tax cuts, which have been occurring under Bush and Obama, you see, $10 trillion, most of it to the wealthy. And that's why, according to studies by University of California economist Emmanuel Saez in his database, 95% of all the national income gains since 2008 has gone to the wealthiest 1%. You know, you make these super speculative profits by turning to finance and all these new financial instruments, the latest of which is bitcoins and cryptos, make these huge profits, and then you get to keep it. Your companies keep it, and what they pass to you, you keep even more. And that's why you get 95% going to the 1%. They are the investors. And as investors, they're turning more and more to financial asset investing. Well, that was the major theme of my previous book in 2016, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. And the latest book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, is about how it all begins with the central banks, you see, and the changing financial structures and labor markets that are the hallmark of neoliberal policies. You see, it's all connected. It's all connected. Okay, so, you know, we talked about nine elements here driving the price of cryptos and bitcoins. Just to summarize briefly here, the ever-increasing search for yield, the shift to professional investing, the fact that the stuff is not taxed, the emergence of options and future derivatives trading on this stuff, the legitimation, you know, with the CME and the big banks and hedge funds and Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Japanese, NVIDIA, these other companies, right, all legitimizing it, multiple ICOs, you know, driving the supply of bitcoins. And we know, you know, price increase the supply of something, the price goes down. You increase the demand for something, the price goes down even, I mean, it goes up. Increase the demand for it, the price goes up even more. Okay, pumping and dumping, there's no regulation, the growing herd mentality, right? The shift of investment funds from gold to cryptos, right? And the massive increase, the start starts it off 30 years from the central bank. Now, there are problems and risks here in this stuff. Now, what are the possible contagion effects? Well, right now, people are saying, well, this is a relatively small market, and it's isolated, and so forth. It's not going to affect the rest of the financial markets and the economy. Not true. Bitcoins are the new subprime derivatives, subprime mortgage bond derivatives, you know, and ETFs are another form of new derivatives, you see. The last crisis at the heart of it was the housing market and subprime derivatives, and now we've got bitcoins and option trading coming on it, and ETFs, and the connection of ETFs to bitcoins will be raising it to another level, all right? And if more non-banks companies accept bitcoins for payment, their balance sheet is going to become increasingly populated with bitcoins. And if the price of bitcoins collapse, then their balance sheets collapse. You see, that's one contagion channel. If we find a growing use of bitcoins for transactions, and the tech companies seem want to expand and quick way to get some money, other than issuing stock equity, right, in which they may lose control of the company, you know, issue bitcoins. You know, that way they just get the money, not the control, right? So, you know, if it spreads to non-bank companies through transactions, which it shows some signs of doing, that will intensify the contagion potential here. But, you know, the real contagion potential, more short-term, I think, is with the Mercantile Exchange, the CME, trading in this stuff. And it could destabilize the bitcoins could destabilize the CME if the price deflation is significant at some point. And that would spill over to other commodity values and prices on the CME. And if commodities collapse as a result, That will spread the contagion to other financial institutions and financial markets and investors in commodities, and that will create a kind of a general financial psychology shift that occurs at the late cycle, and that's how you could spread it to other financial markets. And then I also talked about, you know, if there are crypto ETFs, cryptocurrency ETFs created, that would cause a penetration in the stock and bond markets. So there are channels that are beginning to emerge for contagion, significant contagion. And, you know, then if the pension funds and insurance companies are desperate for yield now, if they start getting into this, you know, that's really going to be a problem. Okay, so we had this price correction here, pullback, 30% this past week. What was that from? That was because the IRS said that the Mercantile Exchange Clearinghouse may have to report transactions in cryptos and bitcoins. Well, that's a signal, right? IRS, you may have to pay taxes on this, folks. All right. So, I didn't have a chance to talk about the warnings of other economists, you know, like Stiglitz. George Stiglitz called it, should be outlawed, it's a bubble, smoke and mirrors. Krugman calls it a consensual hallucination, and so forth. So we'll watch this Bitcoin and speculation. More next week on the final Senate tax bill.